embalmed corpses she had witnessed in the throne tombs of ancient emperors. Somehow she knew instantly that this was the being that had laid the illusory course that had so nearly laid them low. Yet it lay, collapsed and corpse-like, showing no interest at all in her presence. She had moved to within perhaps 50 yards of the dead thing's throne, when a blue light began to shine before the mummified figure, a sheet of sparkling blue motes that coalesced into the form of a small blue-skinned reptile leaning upon a red-gold staff shaped in the image of a coiled serpent. The creature wore a startling headdress of yellow and red feathers, and looping necklaces made from precious metals dangled over its narrow chest. It cocked its head, studying her through small, quick-witted eyes.
"You trespass," it said,
its high-pitched voice strangely melodic.
"This is no land for mortal kind, no place for the living. You bring enemies to this grave city."
"They brought me here, and not by my will," gasped Chev, still unsteady on her feet. "What are you, anyway?"
"Guardians," the creature chirped, "of an ancient evil."
"The silver shard," she whispered, and the creature's clever eyes bored into hers. The chamber shook. Chev turned and saw the doorway rattling under intense force. Vermeer was already past the trapped hallway. Somehow, the door she had so easily passed through was keeping him at bay, but she was sure that could not last long.
"What is this thing?"
Chev whispered, staring at the shifting pattern across the chamber. "Why does Vermeer want it so?"
"It is a relic of a darker time," the creature said. "An abomination that should not exist. It is death and worse, oblivion. Not for mortal hands, young one."
"I remember," said Ecclesius. "I was not a guest here, but a prisoner. Gods save me. I know what it is, Shivanya. The silver shard. I know the truth of it. He cannot have it. He must not have it."
"The Far Walker speaks truth," said the priest, bobbing its head.
"Wait, you can hear his voice?" Chev said, eyes furrowed in confusion.
"My master can, and so passes his voice to me. Our paths have crossed before, when the Far Walker was flesh and blood. He was here at the death of this city."
"At your hands," said Ecclesius. "I remember the stars burning and the screams of the dying. I remember blood staining the streets and the mad laughter of demons. I was bound and chained in this very chamber, another sacrifice for something terrible."
"A great blow was struck against the dark gods that day," said the creature, "at great cost."
Another hammer blow at the door. The golden surface crumbled under the onslaught, dust and dislodged stone pouring through as the hammering continued.
"And you've waited here all these years, just to protect the shard?"
The creature gave a slight chirp, which might have indicated amusement.
"We are not here. We were never here, young one."
"We have to run," she pleaded. "Please, that man searches for this weapon. He is no normal human."
"He is tainted," the creature nodded. "The same darkness that scars his soul also resonates within the silver shard. It calls to him, for it longs to be free. This moment my master has foreseen. No one will leave this place."
No sooner had the creature spoken than a shockwave smashed the doors from their hinges, sending them sliding across the floor. In the entranceway stood Vermeer, staff raised, madness glinting in the sockets of his golden mask. He entered the chamber, flanked by the remaining Zangors. Vermeer's eyes fixed upon the silver shard. It flickered and reformed again, and Chev was sure she saw it take the form of a gleaming longsword, its blade etched with runes, and a single, flawless ruby embedded in its hilt. Then the momentary image was gone.
"Turn back, cursed one," said the lizard priest. "This path leads only to your demise."
Vermeer strode slowly up the steps to the dais, his eyes still fixed upon his prize. Chev backed away slowly, but the man seemed to have forgotten all about her in his obsession. Yarilk and his retinue loomed over the diminutive creature, but it did not seem in the least intimidated by them. It merely tilted its head, as if passingly curious as to their intentions.
"You break the peace of this chamber, and you awaken my lord," trilled the reptile. "Many tasks occupy his sleeping mind, but still he has the power to unmake you all into star matter."
"Silence," spat Vermeer.
He thrust his staff forward at the lizard creature, and from its tip burst a trail of blue-white flame. Barely seeming to move, the lizard wove a net of force in the air, and the unnatural fire poured across its invisible surface like water breaking upon a rock. There was a blinding flash of light and a loud crack, and suddenly a formation of shield-bearing Saurian warriors were arrayed about the priest. They spread out, putting themselves between Vermeer and the silver shard, clubs and axes raised to strike.
"Get out of my way," Vermeer thundered.
Flames erupted from the tip of his staff. Chapter 34. Arika Zenthi rolled underneath the clumsy swing of a beastman's blade and swept her own sword back in a vicious arc, taking the thing's back-jointed leg off at the knee. It collapsed to the floor, shrieking and writhing. She reversed her weapon and stabbed it through the heart.
"Where are these damned things coming from?" roared Bengtson,
who had his back pressed against the far wall and was blasting away with his two heavy pistols. A pile of ruined corpses lay sprawled at the Skybeard's feet. She had to admit he had a knack for this kind of work. More and more of the avian creatures soared down upon those discs of warped metal, hurling themselves into the fray with manic delight. Only the equally deranged bravery of the lizard folk had kept them at bay. Every time a rank of Saurians was brought low by arrows or pierced by the Zangor's silver spears, more warriors appeared, in flashes of searing light, racing into the fray with not a moment's concern for their well-being. Zenthi couldn't care less. If the foolish creatures had such a taste for death, let them do the bloody business of dying, while she and the Duardin stayed as far out of the fray as possible. She spun, carving a cross into the chest of another beastman as she brought her weapons down. The dull creature's eyes went wide, and it gargled on its own blood before toppling to the floor.
"As much fun as this is, we can't keep it up forever," she said, taking a moment to survey the hall.
Acrid smoke from Bengtson's blasting charges lingered in the air, while the dead and the dying littered the floor. Zenthi's ears rang with the sound of the Duardin's pistol as it blazed. Hateful weapons, guns. Useful, of course, but there was no subtlety to them. In her opinion, they were the mark of a clumsy and unskilled warrior.
"I concur,"
Bengtson grunted as he cracked the heavy metal barrel of his handgun over an assailant's head.
"Unfortunately, it seems our tactical opportunities are limited."
Zenthi scanned the entrance hall, looking for anything they could use. She frowned as she noticed an antechamber that ran off to the left, opening out into a wide circular hallway filled with golden statuary.
"Come on,"
she said, grabbing the Duardin's arm and directing him towards the second doorway.
"I think our scaled friends have got this all secured. Let's see if there's anything in this God's forsaken place that's worth our time.
Bengtsson snorted. Did anything catch your eye while you were walking through this desolate place, elf? It's abandoned, and it seems to have been designed by a race with no appreciation for artistry or embellishment beyond a few blank-faced statues and a whole lot of marble. We'd be more likely to... He fell silent as Xenthi placed a hand over the metal grill of his battle mask. She pointed a single, slender finger towards the room ahead. It was filled to the brim with blades, staffs, and other esoteric items, all suspended from the walls with silver chains. The room seemed to stretch on forever, curving around them for at least 500 paces. Paintings hung on the walls, and all along the center of the room ran a series of hexagonal display glasses, filled with all manner of arcane devices and shining jewels. I stand corrected, muttered Bengtsson. The situation is obvious, said Xenthi. Neither of us have yet received any remuneration from that witch hunter, yes? Correct. In which case, I propose that we abandon our heroic defense of the perimeter against the vile hordes and commence a thorough inventory of this chamber to see if there's anything here worth looting. Agreed? Bengtsson's nod of approval was the only affirmation she required. At last, she might begin to make some actual coin from this fool's errand. Chev leapt aside to avoid another torrent of flame and tumbled down the short flight of stairs, landing painfully on her back. The once silent hall had broken into madness as Vamaya and his Zangors unleashed their magics against the city's bizarre defenders. The Saurian warriors were enveloped by twisting trails of silver fire that wound around them like constricting snakes. One lizard approached the circle of Zangor elders, its club raised high to crush Yarilk's head. But before its weapon could descend, a wave of sickening color enveloped its body, trapping it in place. The creature's scaled flesh began to hiss and bubble, and a moment later it evaporated like boiling water, turning into a gust of superheated steam. Chev rolled behind the scant cover of the nearby steps, hurled javelins skipping off the polished floor around her. She looked upon the chaos before her, and knew that Vamaya and the Zangor shaman's combined magic was too much for the defenders. The Saurian creatures bravely threw themselves through the bombardment of magical energy, trying to bury their foes under sheer weight of numbers. But it was futile. The chamber reeked of charred meat and the bittersweet tang of boiling metal. Vamaya lashed his staff across like a headsman's scythe, and a rippling blast of silver-white force erupted out to strike the diminutive reptile priest across the torso, sending his broken body tumbling like a child's toy, bright blood seeping from a diagonal wound across his chest. The mummified corpse upon the golden throne began to twitch and stir. Its gem-studded chair rose, soaring above the furious battle, and the creature's eyes opened. They blazed with the fire of stars. It was agony to even match that primordial gaze, which Chev instinctively knew belonged to a being far older than this forgotten city, far older, perhaps, than the realms themselves. Lightning rippled along the burnished gold of the mummified creature's throne. The form stretched out a hand and channeled this fulminating power into a blast of lightning that careened across the hall and struck two of the Zangor shamans. The beastmen shrieked and howled as their bodies were engulfed in crackling fire, their twisted flesh burned and blackened. Yarilk and his remaining kindred did not falter under the hail. As one, they stowed their curved ritual blades, and each removed a crystal vial filled with shimmering turquoise liquid from their belts. Chanting a mantra in a tongue that sent shivers of revulsion up Chev's spine, the Zangor shamans poured the contents of the crystal vials into their mouths. Their eyes began to burn with unearthly light, and their muscles corded and rippled as the sorcerous concoction seeped through their bodies. Still moving in unnatural synchronicity, the Zangors raised their staffs and unleashed a tidal wave of silver fire that flooded across the hall, immolating the remaining Saurian warriors and engulfing the creature's throne. Shev could see the mummified thing twitching and screaming within the cascade of fire. Vamaya ran towards the silver shard, stretching out one gloved hand.
No!
Gasped the wounded Saurian priest, dragging its body towards Vamaya, blood dripping from its tiny, needle-like teeth.
Mortal hands cannot wield the shard. Its power is too great.
Vamaya laughed bitterly.
I fear there is no longer anything mortal about my flesh, said the masked man.
And with that he tore the black glove from his hand. Underneath was no human arm, but a chitinous gauntlet of azure crystal, from which stared several bloodshot eyes embedded across its length. The tips of the fingers were boneless and shifting like amorphous tentacles. The thing that had once been Ortam Vamaya, High Arbiter of Excelsis, thrust its mutilated limb through the shifting portal. Tol staggered out onto a wide platform of obsidian. It was a great high-ceilinged auditorium, stairs rising towards a great central dais in the distance. He saw the eruption of magic that enveloped the stage, and the strange sight of a floating throne engulfed in fire. He saw Shev Arklis cowering away from the display of ruinous magic. He saw all that, but his eyes were fixed only upon the sight of Ortam Vamaya, grasping in one malformed hand a sliver of shapeless silver. The witch hunter ran, his pistol raised.
Ortam!
He bellowed, and his nemesis looked up with eyes that reflected silver flame. Vamaya's mask melted from his face, as if it had been washed away by rain. In its place, Tol saw the true visage of his old friend and greatest betrayer. The entire left side of the man's face was now a writhing mass of segmented tendrils that looked like nothing less than the twitching legs of a spider. The mouth was dragged down on that same side, half formed into the circular maw of a carrion eel. The left-hand eye had split and poured down towards the cheek, and trails of silver blood were dripping from this awful wound into the man's mouth.
Look upon the face of failure, Hanover, spat Vamaya. Here is what your great victory at Excelsis brought me. Do not worry, my friend. My companions over there assure me this is in fact a blessing.
He began to laugh, hacking up more silver liquid. Despite his hatred for the man, Tol could not help feeling a stab of pity. He could not comprehend what it must have been like, feeling one's body shifting and transforming into something monstrously wrong, the fear and revulsion of one's own flesh. Then he recalled the blood that had flooded the streets of the City of Secrets, and the thousands of honest souls that had burned in witchfire. He remembered his old friend, Khazrug, shot down by this very man, and his compassion melted away in an instant. He fired four blasts. Tol was stunned when Vamaya did not even raise the staff. Instead of striking their target, the bullets were transformed into four yellow-feathered hawks with needle fangs and long drooping tail feathers. They swooped into the air, cawing and screeching. Vamaya laughed.
I did not even mean to do that. I think that mastering this silver shard is going to be a most interesting diversion. You're not leaving here alive, said Tol.
He was vaguely aware of Kallis rushing past him, helping Shev up from the floor.
You've already lost, Hanover. By the Changemaker, this thing, the sheer power of it, it's incredible.
Kallis felt a wave of relief wash through him when he saw Shev was still alive and apparently unharmed. A dozen yards ahead of her, Vamaya's pet beastmen continued to pour a stream of liquid flame onto the throne of that strange, squat creature,
and so involved were they in the spellcraft that they did not seem to notice him at all as he slid into position behind the elf, nestling his Duardin wheel lock against the lip of the shallow staircase.
"By the God King, it's good to see you all right," he said, then pulled his backup pistol from beneath his coat and offered it to her, grip first. "It's loaded and primed. I know you don't much like these, but..."
She practically tore it from his hand and leaned over to plant a fierce kiss on his lips. Was all he managed as she pulled free. Chev just laughed, shaking her head.
"I thought you were dead."
Yes, well, said Callis, trying to recover his composure. "Don't give up hope just yet. I assume you've noticed that we very much failed to keep Vermeier away from that thing."
He raised his head and fired towards the traitor. He'd made kills at a similar range 100 times before, but this time nothing happened. He thought he saw a faint ripple of effervescent light, like a miniature rainbow, but Vermeier did not react.
"There's some kind of spell field around him," said Chev, after firing her own weapon with no greater effect. "Our guns are useless."
There was a sudden rush of air, and Callis was struck with a feeling of intense disorientation, as if he were dangling from the highest mast of the Thrice Lucky in a raging storm. The room seemed to vibrate and roll, and he staggered backwards, seeing Chev roll aside with a groan. The wide chamber rocked with an eruption of immense power. Callis and Chev were sent hurtling backwards, rolling and sliding across the smooth ground. Dust and shattered masonry rained from the ceiling. Through bleary eyes, Callis looked up to see a radiant light where the flaming throne had been only a moment before. Silhouetted before that blazing light were the thin, bent skeletons of the Zangor shamans, little more than etchings made from ash. The light dimmed, and Callis saw the throne descend from on high with slow and steady grace. A creature rested upon that conveyance, charred and burned, but unbowed. Its roomy ancient eyes seemed to bore straight into Callis. It waved a stubby hand in a gesture of utter indifference, and the beastmen's skeletons scattered into nothing. Only the melted husks of their weapons remained, rattling to the floor. The monster that had once been Vermeier turned, raising the silver shard high. Before Callis's eyes, the immense power melted into quicksilver and reformed itself around the shape of his golden staff. The creature upon the throne said nothing, but it gazed imperiously at the twisted human.
"You want his back, do you not?" said Vermeier.
Then he rapped the staff against the chamber floor. A ripple of light ran across the length of his body, and when it receded, that hideous, malformed face was once again the visage of the man who had betrayed Toll and Callis and set Excelsis aflame. Round, slightly boyish, with a smile that did not reach his eyes. Though the mutations had disappeared, Callis's sense of revulsion did not subside. He could still smell the corruption upon the man, a sickly sweet stench like incense mixed with decaying flesh.
"Come and take it, if you can," Vermeier said.
The lizard-like creature gestured at the sorcerer, and the glass portal high above smashed asunder, raining shards of colored crystal all around them. A sliver of glass sliced a red furrow down Callus's face, from his temple to his lower chin, and he cursed and covered his head with his hands. Racing through the shattered window came motes of blazing light, each as large as a human head, burning with the fire of stars. They slammed into Vermeier with horrendous force, but he merely staggered back a few steps and shook his head, laughing. Again, the creature swept its hands out and shaped an arrow of energy that slammed into the former High Arbiter. This strike smashed Vermeier to the floor with the power of a hammer blow. Callis heard the distinct crack of shattering bone and saw a spiderweb of cracks splinter across the obsidian floor.
"That will not do it, creature," said Vermeier, hauling himself to his feet.
Toll ran forward, perhaps hoping to strike at the man with his rapier while the traitor was distracted.
But Vamaya absent-mindedly swung his staff out to the side and sent the witch hunter sprawling.
Let me show you how to dispose of one's enemies, Vamaya growled, and thrust the staff out towards the reptile.
The ground shattered and erupted in spear-length shards of obsidian, a wall of piercing pikes that slammed through the creature's throne, penetrating stone and flesh alike. The creature hissed in agony, and its throne began to soar high towards the ceiling, dripping black blood. Vamaya smiled and gestured again, and this time the very walls of the structure splintered and came apart, forming lashes of stone and crystal which reached out to strike the palanquin. Its occupant wove its arms in desperate patterns, smiting the reaching crystalline whips with blasts of living lightning. But there were simply too many. Callis watched, appalled, as one of the lashing tendrils pierced the bloated beast, tore it bodily from its throne, and flicked its lifeless corpse aside. The creature struck the wall, rolled, and hit the floor of the chamber with hideous force.
No,
whispered Chev, and Callis shared her despair. They knew nothing about the mysterious beast, but it had been a protector and a guardian, they understood. And it had been, perhaps, their only chance of defeating the ascendant Vamaya. The arch-traitor whirled his arms above his head. The cavernous roof of the hall began to come apart, as if caught in the path of a ferocious hurricane. Round and round swirled those tendrils of splintered stone, unmaking the very foundations of the building, tearing a great gaping hole in the featureless dome above. Callis opened fire, as did Toll and Chev, standing amidst the cataclysm and pouring bullet after bullet towards Vamaya. None connected. From the corner of his eye, Callis saw the shattered body of the guardian twitch. One of its eyes was little more than a shapeless red ruin, but the other still burned with intensity. It raised a single webbed hand, and the ground disappeared from underneath his feet. Chapter 35. They had been standing, all of them, within the disintegrating temple. Chev was certain of that. And then, with the abruptness of a flash of lightning, they had been sent elsewhere. They were falling, weightless, through a swirling vortex of colors and shapes that made no sound or sense at all. Freed from gravity and reality and anything comprehensible by the mortal mind. Chev looked down at her body and saw it morph and twist and reshape itself into an impossible fractal collision of bones and skin and clothing. Callis, to her left, was screaming as his body helixed around itself. She was screaming too, she supposed, though her main feeling was a form of detached, maddened curiosity. Then, as one, they slammed to solid earth. Dense, overgrown earth, wet with dew and thick with sharp thorns. Chev staggered to her feet and rose to see Zoantica, as it had once been. She did not know how she knew that, but gazing down upon the majestic sweep of the city, it seemed an undeniable fact. The skies were such a clear, bright blue, it was almost painful to look upon. Surrounding them on all sides were thick, lustrous trees with dangling fronds and brightly colored fruits hanging from their boughs. Ahead, through the dense vegetation, she could see a clearing and the looming shape of some kind of structure. The sounds of life were deafening, the hissing chorus of startled insects and the hoots and shrieks of birds in the trees. Life where none had stirred before. She heard a rustling movement within the tree line.
Sigma's teeth, spat Callis.
He clambered to his feet, looking about as startled and discombobulated as Chev felt. He was waving his pistol around like a drunken man, still clearly disorientated from their bizarre journey.
Where are we?
Said Toll. The witch hunter knelt, running his hand through the wet grass.
This is the very city we entered. But...
He did not finish the thought, but he and Chev shared a knowing glance. Both of them could feel that something unutterably strange had happened here.
"We must keep going," she urged.
They forced their way through the tangle of thick vines, slapping away thumb-sized mosquitoes that buzzed and droned about them. After some effort, they emerged on the crest of a shallow hill and looked out over the city of white and gold. She saw the full beauty of Zoantica for the first time. Enormous spiraling ziggurats rose from a network of immaculate roadways, reaching as high as castle towers. The walls of these great structures were lined in gold, bedecked with strange asymmetrical runes and intricate engravings of stern figures, heads bowed as if in prayer. Amphora carrying statues lining the avenues of the city poured streams of crystal clear water into fountains and softly burbling waterways. There were carriages on the streets, elegantly curved traps pulled by giant, long-beaked birds with iridescent feathers. Pedestrians, too. Humans, mostly, robed and cowled, but here and there the slender forms of elves.
"Where the hells are we now?" whispered Callis. "Inside the Master, Lord Pathaquentos's memories,"
came a chirping voice from behind them, strangely halting in its speech pattern. They turned to see the same diminutive lizard priest that had greeted them in the chamber of Zoantica's great hall. Gone was the ragged tear that Vermaia had opened in the blue-skinned creature's hide. It walked towards them with an odd hopping gait.
"Zoantica, as it was," the creature chirped.
"Quite the place," said Callis.
"A mask, a golden mask to hide the truth," the creature hissed, waving a dismissive claw.
The image of the city blurred and shifted, and they felt the ground surge beneath their feet. When vision came back to them, they were standing inside what appeared to be a temple, shrouded in shadow. Above, braziers of purple fire cast flickering shadows across rows and rows of hooded figures. Each carried a silver knife and wore an ornate mask of silver, studded with gems and engraved with patterns of pale gold. Some of these masks were fashioned in the shape of prey birds, hooked and avian. Others were shaped like grinning half-moons, or horned and fanged beasts. The fug of incense and burning oils hung heavy in the air, seeming to blur the motions of the robed figures. They were chanting low and insistently, in a tongue that sounded like the droning of insects. A column of more than 100 sorry, stick-thin slaves shuffled down towards the center of the chamber, where there lay a circular pool surrounded by stone pillars marked with profane symbols and engraved script. Liquid boiled erratically within that enormous well, occasionally spitting upwards. It looked like molten silver, though Chev thought she could see shapes moving in that morass, a nightmarish and unformed mass of organic matter, compound eyes and lashing tongues.
"Sacrifices," said Toll softly,
staring at the victims as they were led forward. All hope and even fear had gone from their eyes. There was only the dull glaze of resignation.
"Once scholars and masters of magic, lured here by false promises," said their guide, startling Chev.
The creature stood only a few yards from her, gazing at the ceremony with narrowed eyes.
"Zoantica professed to be a city of learning, of reason. All lies, of course. Its rulers cared only for power, forbidden knowledge. The changer of the ways heard their prayers and was gratified by their duplicity."
The slaves lined up around the swirling mass of molten metal. A figure stood upon a raised pulpit at the far end of the room, wielding a silver staff flickering with a turquoise flame. A woman, skeletally thin and with long white hair bound in a knot on the top of her skull. Her mask was smooth and featureless silver, bound so tightly to her face that it almost seemed the gleaming metal was her skin. She wore magnificent purple robes, high-collared and embroidered with intricate patterns of gold and silver. The priestess rapped her staff upon the ground. Several hooded figures below raised their curved daggers and stepped forward. Their knives slashed across the throats of their captives. Chev looked away in revulsion. When she glanced back, trails of bright crimson were mixed in with the shimmering silver, and corpses were strewn across the floor. The quicksilver began to bubble. Mist filled the room as the hooded figures' chanting rose to a demented crescendo. A great claw reached forth from the metallic pool. Then an immense bird-like arm shimmering with iridescent feathers. A jagged beak broke the surface next, a lashing tongue tasting the air with obscene delight. Chev felt a wave of purest terror, such as she had never known before. Beside her, Callus's hand flew to the symbol of the God King he wore around his neck, his expression panic-stricken. The simmering metal and rising steam obscured much, but within the swirling clouds, the shadow of something monstrous, several times the size of a man, could be seen. A hide of iridescent colors, rippling with corded muscle, coils of night-black scales, an abomination from another realm, forcing its way into reality. Within the glittering mass, a slimy lens peeled back to reveal a yellow orb that blazed with primordial malevolence. In that gaze was a horrifying madness, a gateway to a trillion nightmarish futures of agony and torment. Chev clutched her chest, staggered backwards. Time stopped. Around them, the ranks of robed cultists froze in the midst of their exultations, daggers raised high in triumph. The choking fog grew thicker, mercifully masking the horror in the molten pool.
"What in Sigmar's name was that thing?"
Callus gasped, wiping blood from a split palm across his coat. Chev realized that he had clutched the God King's relic so tightly it had pierced his skin.
"A demon," Tol answered, suddenly looking very old. "A powerful, greater demon."
The lizard priest bared his needle-like teeth.
"Servant to the Lord of Lies," it hissed. "Thank your gods you did not witness its true form, only an echo of the past, a memory."
Chev wished she had seen nothing at all. When she closed her eyes, she still saw the malignant eye seared upon her brain, the sulphurous stench of its flesh still souring her nostrils.
"Nem-Kawet was the name the demon gave," the creature continued. "The Lord of Silver Skies, not its true name. The mortals' worship drew it forth to ravage the realms once more, and in return it offered them a gift of unimaginable power."
Their surroundings twisted once more. Suddenly they were atop the highest peak of Zoantica's Golden Tower. An enormous disc-shaped platform opened to the sky. Surrounding the city on all sides were mountain peaks, obscured by rain that lashed down in stinging sheets. The purple-robed figure they had seen in the sacrificial chamber now stood before a pyre of purple flames, within which writhed malformed shapes. Flames lashed out angrily from the pyre, though they could not breach the warding circle that was marked upon the floor, a hexagrammatic shape formed from bloody corpses. Mortal cultists stood surrounding this hideous scene, divested of robes. Lightning flickered across bare, pale flesh that was marked with tattoos and ritual scars. They were guarding yet more prisoners, these ones shivering and terrified, some lolling and screaming incomprehensibly, clearly driven to madness by their suffering. The white-haired woman reached a hand into the flames, which coiled around her body to no avail. With a scream of triumph, she drew forth a blade of pure silver. It was almost impossible to fix one's eyes upon that sword, for it seemed to pulse and flicker in and out of reality, changing form with every passing moment.
Nemkawet's gift, a weapon born from the purest insanity of the Chaos Realm, imbued with the stuff of demonkind,
the lizard priest spat. Letting out a howl of exultant triumph, the sorceress flicked the blade at the nearest bound prisoners. A beam of sickening unlight washed across them. They screamed helplessly as their bodies melted into a tangle of yellow-banded, triple-headed serpents. The cultists of Zoantica fell to their knees, raising their hands in worship of their unspeakable master. Their voices frenzied as they screamed their praise to the skies. The priestess raised the weapon again and muttered a profane incantation. Corpuscent light enveloped the platform as a beam of crackling energy reached far into the distance, scattering the tenebrous clouds as it roared above the earth. This lance of silver-white energy struck the distant peak of a mist-shrouded mountain, enveloping it in a writhing web of phosphorescence. With a sound like a great dam bursting, the mountainside melted, pouring down the valley like a golden flood, releasing torrents of glittering steam into the sky.
"Its power was terrible even then," the creature continued. "Even from afar, my master sensed the violence of its birthing. A blade to cut the strands of fate, to unmake the great tapestry. It could not be."
Time shifted once more. Night and day whirred past with dizzying speed. They watched as Zoantica grew, greater and grander than ever before. Endless columns of slaves poured into the city, guarded by legions of masked warriors. The city rose, tearing free of the earth, and the Talon Coast fell away beneath them. As if at the hands of a god, the very shape of the Fate Scar Mountains began to change, molded into being by waves of blinding light. Defeated kingdoms were cowed, their masters dragged through Zoantica's streets in chains. Armies of winged creatures, golden-helmed and beautiful, sought to lay the masters of the city low, but they were defeated alongside all the others, their wings broken and their ankles shackled. Shev and the others saw all this in a matter of moments, a dizzying rush of images that seared into their minds and made the stars spin overhead. And then, with terrible suddenness, the passage of time ceased. Shev collapsed to her knees, gasping for breath, her head spinning. She looked up to see that they were in the grand plaza of Zoantica, which was lined with cowled figures. There was the masked priestess, surrounded by armed thralls and cultists, tracing burning sigils in the air. The woman carried the demon's gift in steady hands. There was a faint halo of orange flickering above the canopy of the surrounding halls, and Shev smelled smoke upon the air. Screams echoed in the distance. War had come to the streets of Zoantica. The stars overhead burned with blinding light, transforming night to day in an instant. Columns of starlight slammed into the plaza's marbled tiles, coalescing into ranks of saurians and mighty war beasts. Shev saw lizard warriors mounted upon bipedal reptiles with bone-crushing jaws, lumbering spiked behemoths with diminutive saurians scampering across howdahs raised on their sturdy backs. There, in the center of this star host, was the same bloated creature that had rested upon the dais, though here its flesh was lustrous and its eyes blazed with the light of the heavens. The Zoanticans joined their voices in blasphemous communion, and the silver shard flared in the darkness. A sickening wound tore open in the sky, vomiting varicolored light across the forum. From this breach poured a tide of capering pink-skinned monsters with gangly limbs and wide brimstone eyes. Something else stirred behind that roiling portal, and insane laughter rolled across the land like thunder. Unperturbed, the reptilian army came on. The mortal cultists leapt towards their enemy with no thought for their own lives, loosing bolts of silver-white energy that blasted apart onrushing Saurians. Gangling demons spat fire, and in turn were crushed or blasted apart by spiked clubs or pierced by javelins of black stone. Lord Pathequentos soared across the battlefield at the head of his star-born host, straight towards the wielder of the silver shard. Lashes of power from the priestess cut down the scaled warriors. The silver shard sang shrilly in the heretic's hands as it slew, making Chev's ears ache as though they were bleeding. The masked woman struck the shard against the paving of the plaza, and the ground split open. Waves of magma vomited through the split, drenching cultists and Saurians alike, melting them to ash. She flicked the shard and tore gilded columns the size of Ongoro trees free from their roots. They hurtled through the air to crash amongst the invaders, crushing them beneath the weight of the grinding marble. Lord Pathequentos came on, through the rain of magma, deflecting the sizzling downpour with a dismissive wave. Meteors screamed in his wake towards the priestess. Chev's heart leapt as the priestess barely raised the silver shard in time. The flaming missiles disappeared in a burst of light, turning into clouds of many-hued dragonflies, which danced in the air. The battle that followed was almost impossible for Chev to interpret. The storm of magic was blinding, a display of cataclysmic power that filled the air with fire and raining comets. Ruptured bodies littered the ground, and demonic forms cavorted amongst the smouldering ruins of the once great city. On the steps of the great palace, the battle was won. Opening his stubby arms wide, Pathequentos raised his hands, and the tortured night skies flooded with light. Rays of celestial magic speared down to immolate demons and cultists alike. And where they struck Saurian warriors, the scaled ones were enveloped in radiant energy, their wounds fading away, and their relentless assault intensified. The priestess of Zoantica cowered under the sudden blare of light. An enormous bipedal war beast barreled through the press of bodies, bellowing in fury. Its rider, an armored reptilian warrior, roared in triumph, his spear taking aim at the bearer of the silver shard. The war beast grabbed the priestess in its jaws, and fangs the size of swords crunched down with terrible force. The cursed weapon fell from its wielder's lifeless hands, clattering down the steps of the palace to land before the palanquin of Lord Pathequentos. Even as it lay untouched, the blade began to shimmer. It twisted and reformed, turning into a flowing lash of quicksilver, and then a great avian talon. Finally, it settled into the image Chev had first laid eyes upon in the Grand Chamber, a twisting wound in reality, trembling with barely suppressed power. The tableau froze once more.
"The battle was fierce, the city destroyed, though at great cost to my master," said the lizard priest, and Chev thought she heard a hint of sadness in its melodic voice. "The masters of Zoantica were all slain, but the stain of their evil was not swept away."
"The silver shard," said Tol,
"could not be destroyed."
The creature bobbed its head.
"Not without great cost. Master's power has kept the sword hidden, safe, until now."
"And now Vermeia has it," said Callis, "and we're all about to find out just how bad that is."
"Time is an enemy now," the creature continued. "Lord Pathequentos is gravely wounded, and this moment slips away like sand through our claws."
"Then why are we here? Where have you taken us?" demanded Tol.
"Nowhere. My master plucked this moment in time out of the great tapestry and drew you here. Will not last for long, but it will serve."
They heard footsteps upon the hard stone of the tower top, and turned to see a figure approaching them. a short, balding man, skin weathered by the sun. He was dressed in the same rags that the sacrificial victims had worn. His body was thin and marked with bruises and cuts. Though his cheeks were gaunt and his eyes sunken, Chev recognized the face of Ecclesius the Realmswalker, the greatest statesman and traveller of his age, from her books. It was the same slight, weak-chinned visage she had seen in the man's tomb, but here. He stared at his hands in wonder, pinching the flesh of one palm and wincing slightly as he did so.
"I live again," he said. "Flesh and bone. How is this possible?"
"It is not," said the creature. "Only memory. You were here on this day, far traveller. You were here at the fall, at the death of Zoantica. That is how you are present."
Callis raised his hand, an expression of utter confusion on his face. "Would someone care to explain who in the eight realms this balding fellow is?" he said.
"I am Ecclesius the Realmswalker, scion of Aceltane, and—"
"This stone,"
Chev explained, cutting Ecclesius off and raising the shade-glass gem.
"This man was once a traveller, an explorer who journeyed far across the eight realms,"
Chev explained to the bewildered-looking Callis.
"Upon his death, he had his memories, his soul essence, stored inside a shade-glass crystal."
"To simply fade from the world, all my experiences lost to the ages,"
said Ecclesius.
"That I could not abide. The great Cataphranes of Shadespire demanded a high price indeed for that crystal, but I paid it gladly."
"So he's been, what, in your head this whole time?" said Callis.
"In a way," said Chev, "it's complicated." "No time," hissed the priest. "No time for this. You were here, far traveller. Amongst thousands, your life alone was spared. We shaped your memories before we released you, so that you could not remember what you saw when Zoantica died."
Ecclesius's eyes furrowed in confusion.
"I remember all of my travels, but I remember nothing of this city beyond a few scattered images. All I know is that I witnessed something terrible here. Why? Why was I not killed when you purged the life from this city?"
"Your fate is bound to the stars. You have been marked in the grand constellation, far traveller."
The creature looked at them all in turn.
"Same for you, young ones. This moment was mapped in the stars long ago by the old ones. This is why your lives have been spared."
"Enough of this cheap prophecy.
Vermeer has the silver shard,"
Toll continued.
"Every moment we delay, the more damage he can wreak. Take us back, now."
The reptile's wide, unblinking orbs fixed upon the witch hunter.
"You cannot win," it said.
It didn't seem possible that the creature's long snout and toothy maw should be able to even pronounce the common tongue, yet it spoke the words with perfect clarity.
"With the silver shard, the fang of Nemkawet, in his grasp, the sorcerer is beyond your powers to slay. There is only one way to be rid of it."
"What do you intend?"
asked Toll.
"Give the master time. Distract the human for but a few moments. Lord Pathakwentos can open a breach to the shrieking nothingness, the void between realms. There we will trap the silver shard where none can ever reach it."
"Why didn't you do this before?" asked Chev. "Why didn't you get rid of the damn thing while there was still time?"
The creature's gaze turned to her. It cocked its head slightly, staring at the shade-glass amulet around her neck. And despite herself, her hands twitched towards the gem.
"Not easily done," said the creature. may kill the master, and he has much still to do. Many tasks to be accomplished across the starways. The stars burn in the fires of war, and my master's kind are few. Each death is a defeat. Yet this mortal must not take the shard. No choice. And you?
She said. Again it cocked its head in that curious manner. Shev was sure she caught a flicker of amusement in the creature's expression, although it was almost impossible to tell for certain.
No more real than this earth,
it trilled, tapping its claws upon the dewy ground.
Only my master's memory, his last memory, and now our time is almost over. But there is another price, the reason we once spared your life.
The creature turned to Ecclesius.
The gem of soul crystal that binds your astral form,
it said.
We must trap the sorcerer within. In possession of the silver shard, he might escape from the great nothing. Such is its power. No, we must trap him as we bound Nemkawet.
Wait, what will happen to Ecclesius? Said Shev.
The creature tilted its head again.
He will join my master in oblivion,
it said. Ecclesius closed his eyes and shook his head.
Not now, he whispered. Not when I am finally free.
There has to be some other way, said Shev softly, knowing as she spoke that her words were meaningless.
It's a sorry hand you've been dealt, said Callis, fixing the realm's walker with a sympathetic look. But if we don't defeat Vermeier here, we're all doomed regardless.
So are thousands more innocent lives. Vermeier means to burn Excelsis to the ground, and that is simply the beginning, said Toll. The power to wreak such damage in that man's hands, it cannot be allowed, no matter the cost.
The witch hunter strode over to Ecclesius and looked into his eyes without flinching.
I'm sorry, but you have already lived your life, he said. If your existence has to end so that others may live on, then so be it.
Not your choice, said the priest,
then raised a claw to point at Ecclesius.
His only. Must not resist when my master draws his spirit from the stone. If he does, then the sorcerer will surely break free, will not hold for long, but long enough.
I shall not resist, said Ecclesius.
He looked up and met Shev's eye. She saw fear there, but resolve too.
You are right, Master Toll. I have already lived far too long. Perhaps it is time to rest, at last.
Shev stepped forward and took the old man's hand. He was trembling.
Thank you, she said.
Ecclesius smiled and grasped her arm.
Promise me you'll continue my life's work, he said. In my name, see the wonders of the realms. There are so many sights to see, Miss Arklis, so many beautiful things, even amidst the darkness and chaos of war. I have yet to see more than a fraction of what there is out there. Now I know that I never will. But you can. You're going to achieve great things, I'm sure of it. I should have liked to accompany you, but it is enough for an old man to know there are others walking in his footsteps.
In your name, Shev said, I swear it. I'll see it all.
Should I meet your father in the afterlife, I'll tell him all about our travels together. I'm sure he would be very proud of who you have become.
No more time, said the creature, staring up at the heavens.
Shev held the realm's walker's hand, while the storm broke over them. Thunder rolled overhead, and where there once had been dark skies, cracks of searing light were breaking through. The golden ziggurats of Zoantica began to crumble and fall, collapsing in on each other level by level. Then the ground gave way beneath their feet, and once more they were falling into darkness. Shev saw the Saurians' small, clever eyes one last time before they were swallowed up by enveloping night. Chapter 36. Tol's eyes opened, and he was once again in the collapsing grand hall of Zoantica, the deafening sounds of disintegrating masonry filling his ears. He rolled to his feet, ignoring the sheet of white fire that enveloped his chest as he rose. At least 3 ribs broken. They ground and clicked against each other when he moved. The agony was exquisite and stole his breath. Hate came to his rescue, lighting its own fire inside him and burning away the weakness of pain. Vamaya was still alive, and the bastard thought he was going to escape justice once again. Tol had decided that he was very much willing to die to see his former ally served his due.
Ortam!
He bellowed, throwing his useless pistol aside and drawing his rapier. Vamaya turned, a mad light shining in his eyes, somehow even more unsettling than the ruin his face had been. He laughed, taking in the witch hunter's battered appearance.
I should have known you wouldn't lie down so easily, he said. You know, you're a very stubborn man, Hanover. It can be most irritating.
I see you've given up using a blade, said Tol. You used to consider yourself quite the swordsman, if I recall. Of course, I cut your face the last time we dueled.
Vermeer's eyes narrowed.
Tol, are you trying to anger me? That's really quite unnecessary.
You know, you did have me fooled, Ortam. I admit it. Your betrayal shocked me to the core of my soul. You had every advantage over me, and still you failed.
The traitor was advancing upon him now, his frenzy of destruction forgotten. He swung the silver shard low, and as it moved, its form flowed into that of a dueling saber, still rippling with molten energy.
You had the city at your mercy. You had your moment, the moment you'd spent your life in preparation for, and you let it slip from your fingers. I would say your wretched god is very angry with you, Ortam, and as powerful as your new toy is, I don't think it'll stay his wrath.
I care nothing for the gods, spat Vermeer. I only ever cared for what they could grant me. And now I no longer require the changemaker's aid. Here, let me show you what I mean.
He lunged forward. Tol had forgotten how fast the man was. He was a born duelist. Last time they had fought, during the last fight for Excelsis, only good fortune had seen Tol escape with a narrow victory. This time, luck was not with him. He managed to pull back from the blow, but not far enough. Vermeer's blade sank deep into the meat of his upper arm, burning as it tore through flesh and bone. Tol gasped and fell to his knees, his own rapier tumbling from his hand. Vermeer's face leered at him, and through the mask of illusion, he briefly saw again the monstrous form beneath.
You took my moment of glory from me, said Vermeer, his teeth bared like a rabid hound. Let me take something from you, old friend.
He stepped back and brought his blade around in a tight arc. White, hot agony engulfed Tol's arm, and he heard something thud to the floor. Knowing what he would see, but somehow also not believing it, Tol glanced down to see his severed arm lying in a pool of spreading blood. Callis was too slow, He saw the blade fall and Toll's arm fly free, trailing an arc of spurting blood. The witch hunter sagged to one knee, gasping in pain. One hand went to the torn stump below his shoulder. Vermeer circled, twirling his blade in a duelist's flourish, delight writ large upon his features.
It's a terrible thing, is it not, to find one's body altered forever, he said.
Callis charged across the floor and leapt at Vermeer. He crashed into him, bearing him to the floor and raining heavy punches into his face. It was like striking stone. He felt his knuckles crack, but knew that the moment he let up, he was dead or worse. Callis had to buy time. He rolled, slipping through Vermeer's guard and wrapping his forearm around the man's throat in a chokehold. He hauled back with all his might, but it was futile. Vermeer twisted his shoulder and hurled Callis free. The throw sent him tumbling painfully across the floor, but he turned the painful impact into an awkward roll and came up firing from the hip, discharging both barrels of his Duardin piece. The bullets struck a wall of invisible force and erupted into bursts of blinding color.
"It's very touching, this," said Vermeer, "the protégé, defending his master. What do you suppose your chances are in this instance?"
"Better than yours," Callis replied, seeing a flicker of movement behind the sorcerer. Chev pressed her weapon against Vermeer's back and fired. Blood splattered across the floor, and Vermeer staggered, growling in pain.
"Miss Arklis," came Ecclesius's voice.
The Realmswalker's voice was strained and weak inside her head.
"His will is so strong. I can feel it pressing down upon me, even now. There is something unutterably powerful growing inside his flesh. The creature was right. We must finish him for the good of all."
"Oh, Shivanya," Vermeer hissed, standing upright with a grimace. "I had no intention of killing you along with these fools, but I see now that you cannot be trusted." He moved like flowing water, so fast she barely had time to flinch before his punch struck her in the stomach, sending her skidding across the floor, groaning in agony.
"And so," Vermeer continued, "I am disinclined to offer you that luxury. You should have chosen my side, Shivanya."
"Don't call me that," she growled, wiping blood from her mouth and clambering to her feet. If she was to die here, she would do so spitting in this monster's face. He was closing on her. She could smell the foul, perfumed reek of him, and she wondered how she had ever been able to stand it. His eyes were bloodshot, crazed. They stared straight through her.
"This is it, Shivanya," said
Ecclesius the Realmswalker, and though his voice was weak, there was a calm acceptance to it.
"I would like to thank you for this last journey. It has been most delightful to spend time in your company, and I wish you nothing but the best of fortune in the years to come."
"I'm sorry," she whispered, feeling numb and helpless and hating herself for it. "I'm sorry I couldn't help you."
"Nonsense, my dear. Nothing to be done about it. If nothing else, this is surely a fitting end for a life as rich and, dare I say it, glorious as mine. Goodbye, Miss Arklis."
Something lifted Chev and sent her sliding away across the floor. The shade-glass crystal flew from her grip. Toll felt the blood pouring from his arm in gushing torrents and knew that it was over. Even if they somehow made it out of this room alive, there would be no making it back across the city before he bled out. Callis's face swam into focus. He was shouting something, but Toll couldn't quite make out the words. Blackness seeped into the corners of his vision. Then there was a ragged, terrified scream. Blearily, Toll looked up from where he lay and saw the ruined form of the Lord Pathaquentos, once more seated upon the remnant of its stone palanquin, which was held together by arcing streams of lightning. It hovered in place before Ortam Vermeer, who was enveloped in a field of that same fulminating energy. The stench of burning flesh was overwhelming. Even as the man struggled and writhed, Pathakwentos raised its stubby arms high, weaving an incredibly complex series of gestures in the air. Ecclesius's shade-glass gem floated in the air in front of the creature, crackling with energy. At first, nothing happened. Then there was a whistling shriek of tortured air. Slowly, but with gathering inevitability, a tear began to open in the world. Where the aura surrounding the silver shard had been that of misplaced, overlapping realities, this breach spilled only thick, all-encompassing darkness into the world. Vermeer struggled free of the web of energy and swung his silver blade into the chest of Pathakwentos, but the creature did not even seem to register the surely fatal blow, even as blood bubbled in its wide maw and poured down its chest. Instead, they could hear a low, throaty murmuring, and it continued to craft a final spell. Something silver-white rushed out from the crystal and ricocheted across the room like a bouncing ball of lightning. Vermeer was dragged forwards. His hideous face began to twist and deform, flesh drawn from his bones towards the crystal. Vermeer shrieked and tried desperately to drag himself away, but his feet slipped on the smooth floor and he could make no progress. Toll could see the panic in his old friend's eyes as he realized his doom. He felt no pride or delight in witnessing this, only relief that he had at last earned justice for the dead of Excelsis before the end. The black hole was still growing now, and it seemed to drain all the light and sound from the chamber. Chev was crawling towards them, looking over her shoulder in fear at the spreading vortex. At this pace, it would soon devour them all. In one final desperate attempt to escape his fate, Vermeer began to hack wildly at Pathakwentos, carving through flesh and stone. The wizened creature, somehow still alive, simply rested its hands upon the man's chest, and with its dying breath, mouthed one last arcane phrase. With one final agonized scream, Vermeer's spirit was torn from his body, disappearing into the shade-glass gem, which flared and crackled with energy. His lifeless body crumpled and was sucked into the vortex before Pathakwentos reached out a stubby hand to grasp the scintillating blade of the silver shard. Its flesh began to bubble and boil away, but the creature seemed to ignore the pain. The spreading orb of oblivion now enveloped the raised dais entirely. Pathakwentos released his hold upon the floating crystal containing whatever remained of Vermeer's essence, which followed after the man's corpse. Then, his great eyes closed and the silver shard clutched to his chest, the master of Zoantica was drained into the vortex of devouring nothingness, his body tumbling and whirling away into the distance.
"To the void with you, Vermeer,"
Toll whispered, and then began his own journey into darkness. Chapter 37. The rift continued to widen, tendrils of antimatter reaching out to steal the life and color from the world. Enormous masonry chunks dropped from the ceiling to smash upon the chamber floor, sending up great explosions of dust and shards of splintered stone.
"Toll! Toll!"
Kallus was shouting, slapping the oblivious witch hunter about the face in an attempt to bring him out of his stupor. Chev put a hand to the prone man's chest. She felt him breathing, but it was shallow and faint. She did not think he had more than a few minutes to live.
"Armand!"
she shouted, gripping the soldier by his shoulders and shaking him. He stared at her, blood and dust smeared all across his face.
"We have to get out of here, or we'll all follow Vermeer into oblivion."
He nodded, and stooped to gather Toll in his arms, straining as he hefted the comatose man onto his back. They struggled to move, for each of them now felt the pull of the widening vortex, reaching out to tug at their bodies. Chev thought to say that they should leave Toll here, but Callis had a look of formidable determination about him, and she knew he would countenance no such thing. Together, they half ran, half staggered to the stairway, and began to descend. The ground shook beneath their feet. Chev had lived through an earthquake before, and she knew that they had almost no chance of outrunning the blast radius. The sole comfort she found was that she felt awake and focused in a way that she had not in all the time they had spent in Zoantica. Something had changed, as if she had just awoken for the very first time. That sense of crushing doom she had felt ever since she had followed Vermeer into the depths of the Forgotten City had mercifully ceased. Where before the journey up this staircase had felt like some kind of purgatorial nightmare, now she could see all the way down to the entrance hall far below. It was littered with corpses, and there was no movement down there. They were perhaps a third of the way down the spiraling stairway when there was another, fiercer tremor that sent them skidding to their knees. Chev looked up and saw the black orb of nothingness stretching out to consume the apex of the tower. The arched roof tore away into the void, and Chev saw the inky blackness of the rift meet a slate-gray sky, its all-consuming darkness seeping into the world like oil into water. Callis helped her upright, somehow still managing to drag Toll's body alongside him. They bounded down the steps as fast as their aching legs allowed, bursting out into the charnel pit that was the entranceway. Chev noticed that there were none of the Saurian creatures amongst the dead. Apparently they had left Zoantica alongside their master. Neither could she see the bulky armor of Admiral Bengtson or the night-black leathers of Arika Zenthi, both of whom, according to Callis, had been left to guard the stairway, though there was no time to search the scene. At last, they burst out into open air, racing down the steps while the building came apart behind them. The shadow of the vortex swept across the plaza, bathing the square in darkness. But beyond, she could see the city stretching away into the distance, and beyond that, the mist-wreathed mountains of the Fate Scars.
"Get a god's damned move on!" came a voice from far ahead, barely loud enough to be heard over the roar of the collapsing city. It was Zenthi, on the far side of the plaza, leaning heavily on Bengtson, clutching her side in a manner that indicated she had taken a nasty wound. They raced across the open ground and reached the battered pair of shipmasters, who were covered in blood and grime. Bengtson's helm had been marked by a vicious diagonal cut that had almost breached his armor, and he was favoring one leg and breathing heavily. Zenthi was grimacing in pain, and it looked as though she had been run through or pierced by an arrow, for her coat was soaked in blood and her breathing was wet and ragged.
"I think that our fine fellowship now comes to an end," she growled. "There's no way we're outrunning death this time."
Bengtson grunted, a sound that might have been affirmation. Zenthi was right, Chev knew. She turned and gazed up at the orb of nothingness, which had grown to envelop the domed hall. As they watched, the structure disintegrated, clouds of bricks and shattered glass draining away into the hungry void, the great marble face of the building cracking and crumbling. With a thunderous explosion, the front of the building came apart, and the entire structure was swallowed up into darkness. Still not sated, the crackling tendrils of the void stretched out, seeking fresh sustenance.
"There's no escaping that," panted Callis.
His hands were trembling with exhaustion. Chev had no idea how the man had managed to haul his companion so far without pausing for breath.
"No,"
she whispered, and sat down on the flagstones, sighing as she massaged her aching muscles. Even now the rift was eating up the distance between them, ripping tiles and stones from the plaza.
You know, since I joined your one-armed master's mad crusade of vengeance, I've lost my ship, been hurled in the dungeons, been stabbed by a bird-faced mutant, and now I'm about to be swallowed up by the abyss, said Xenthi, spitting up a mouthful of blood. Oblivion will come as something of a relief.
Well, if you're all so intent on dying along with this city, mayhap I should leave upon the Indefatigable by myself, said Bengtson.
They turned as one to stare at him, and he jerked an armored hand towards the mountains. There, sailing out of the mist amidst a cloud of thick gray smoke, was the Admiral's flagship, making straight for their position.
If there's one thing you can rely upon, it's that my crew will want to ensure my survival, said Bengtson.
Wonder if my own sea wolves would be so loyal, muttered Xenthi.
Loyalty? Asked the Admiral, as if he had never heard the word before. No, 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 my dear Captain Xenthi. Pragmatism is a far more reliable motivator. I earned command by Mehret, and every soul aboard that vessel knows that their profits would sink like a harpooned tuvask without me leading them.
He reached into his belt and withdrew a small brass-handled pistol with a wide, stubby barrel. He raised it into the air and fired, and a flare of bright red raced into the air and detonated in a shower of sparks. Closer and closer the airship came. They ran to meet it, while the rift widened and stretched behind them, gaining with every passing moment. The great bulbous shape of the Duardin ironclad dropped out of the clouds, turning broadside in the middle of the central thoroughfare. Chev saw armored figures with those familiar sphere-shaped backpacks dashing across the deck, launching themselves over the side and soaring out towards their band. They gathered Bengtson and Xenthi first, grasping the pair under the arms and lifting them into the air. Then, like a flock of oversized insects, the rest of the engineers descended. Chev felt rough hands grasp her by the shoulders, and then her feet left the ground, and she was kicking empty air as she rose up towards the deck of the Indefatigable. As she soared over the deck, the grip released, and the studded iron surface rushed up with fearsome speed. She hit hard, but turned the fall into an awkward roll.
Pull away, Bengtson ordered, slapping away the attention of his crew, who were checking him for signs of injury.
The engine spheres flared, and the ship's iron hull began to creak and groan as the great vessel swung back, away from the growing disaster enveloping Zoantica. Callis and Toll were dropped to the deck, the latter only slightly more carefully than Chev had been. She rushed over and checked Toll's pulse. Astonishingly, there was a faint beat there, though the man's flesh was cold and dry as a corpse.
He needs a healer, said Callis,
who was slumped against the gunwale, breathing heavily, too exhausted to move. Chev dragged herself to the rail of the ship and slumped against it as the crew of the Indefatigable rushed to their stations, and the huge skyship slowly began to haul itself away from the dying city. The vortex was now a howling globe that dominated the skyline all around them, and its tendrils crackled and grasped empty air mere yards from the gleaming hull of the ironclad. She could feel their monstrous pull tugging at her flesh, sending her hair whipping over her head. She gripped the edge of the gunwale so hard it hurt. The engine spheres above protested loudly, and as one of the tendrils of darkness brushed against the dull brass surface, it loosed panels and rune-etched vents, which tumbled away into nothingness. The city itself was crumbling apart all around, buildings collapsing in on themselves, streets dissolving brick by brick. Snaking rivers of shattered marble and gold trailed into the mouth of the great maw. The Indefatigable pitched terribly, sending Duardin crew stumbling and sliding across its deck, and for an awful moment she thought that it was going to tip over and spill them all out into empty space. But then the spherical engine roared with fresh power, and the great vessel began to pull away towards the mountains, rising into the sky and away from the dead city of Zoantica. The growing vortex began to split the entire floating mountain apart. Enormous splinters ran through the bedrock of the island. Great valleys were torn open in the ragged earth, and towering shelves of rock bent and gave way under the unthinkable pressure. The majestic stone face upon which the lost city had sheltered began to morph and leer as it was rent asunder. Now the sky vortex was bigger than Zoantica itself, a nucleus of pure darkness at the heart of the mountain, still feeding upon the raw matter of existence. There was a crack louder than a myriad of thunderstorms discharging at once, and the floating island split apart, the lower half of the titanic face sundered as if it had been struck by an enormous axe. The stern brow and forehead of the mountain, which made up the crown of the floating island, was swallowed into the void. It was as if this final act of consumption finally sated the black hole's voracious hunger. The orb of destruction began to flicker and collapse, falling in upon itself. A shockwave rushed out to buffet the indefatigable, spinning the ship about. Steel plates groaned as the helmsman struggled to compensate for the buffeting winds. The lower half of the mountain collapsed, whatever magic held its brethren up, entirely obliterated by the unthinkable eruption that had occurred. It fell from the skies in terrible slow motion and struck the sweeping lowland jungle below. An enormous cloud of dust spread as a secondary shockwave was unleashed, flattening trees and sending rippling tidal waves arcing out to sea. Chev watched in horror as the waters of the Talon coast churned into a boiling tsunami and swept across the land to the horizon and beyond. Kallis leaned alongside Chev, his bloodied face pressed against the cold metal. He whistled softly as the devastation unfurled beneath them.
"That's something you don't see every day," he muttered.
Chapter 38. 4 months later. Kallis awoke with a start, sitting bolt upright, his heart hammering in his chest. The sheets were damp with sweat, even though a brisk breeze was drifting through the open window. Judging by the lilac glow that filled the room, it was sometime in the early morning. He could already hear the clatter of carts passing along the cobbled road outside, and the shouts of tradesmen on their way to the Circle Market. He blinked sleep out of his eyes and tried to banish the image that had dragged him into wakefulness. A single yellow eye, wreathed in fire and madness, staring into his very soul. He wondered if the terror of that moment would ever leave him. Worse still, he wondered if he would ever stop imagining what horror had been obscured at the heart of that mist-shrouded chamber, the demon's true form. "Nightmares again?" said Chev. Kallis gave a start, torn from his uneasy thoughts. The elf was dressing, pulling on her tunic and securing her belt, her body silhouetted by the early morning light. On the sill of the tavern window rested a travel bag of cured leather. "You're leaving," he said, and it wasn't a question. He had expected this, though that fact didn't stop it from hurting. They'd only had a few blessed weeks to share one another's company, and he found that he would miss the experience intensely. She sighed and turned.
"I would never have left before you awoke," she said.
"You could stay," he offered, but the words sounded weak and futile even to him. They both knew the truth. Their lives were simply heading down different paths.
He sighed and sat upright, bunching the sheets around him.
"I made a promise to a friend," she said, "to chart the realms and to carry on the great legacy that Ecclesius started all those years ago. I intend to keep my word. And anyway, this life you lead, it's not one I can share. I know it's something you believe in, so I won't ask you to leave it behind and come with me. We had our moment, and I'm so glad to have met you."
She moved to him, leaned down and kissed him, long and fiercely. Then she moved back to the window and gathered her satchel.
"Where will you go?" he asked.
"Wherever the wind takes me. There's an expedition heading into the Tayungra Valley in search of the seeing stones of Prensis that's caught my interest. Or perhaps I'll read through my father's notes. He always talked about tracking down the seven tombs of the Ulkurian pharaohs."
"Just try and keep out of trouble, will you?" he said. "No more accepting dubious offers of assistance from masked figures. That never ends well."
Shev smiled at that. "I believe that we will see each other again, Armand," she said. "The realms are infinite, but we'll bend them to our will. You'll see. I wonder who we'll be when fate brings us together a second time. It's exciting to think that, isn't it?"
Callis thought the chance of them seeing each other again extremely unlikely, but thought better of saying it. This parting was painful enough already.
"Take care of yourself, Shivanya," he said.
"You too, Armand."
And with that, she was gone. Toll was indeed at his usual spot at the Hammerhead, a Duardin-run tavern that overlooked the dock district on the eastern rise of Traders Row. It was mid-morning now, and already the piers and jetties were thick with bodies, muscular ship-hands hauling produce and nimble-tongued merchants trying to score themselves a good deal. The sky was clear, a rarity in excelsis, and in the far distance one could see the sails of Xenthi's privateer fleet flitting between the rows of moored vessels, keeping a close watch on their flock. The witch-hunter had taken a table in the shade at the far side of a small balcony, covered by a canopy of coloured shark hide. He leaned back in his chair, sipping from a glass of crystal-clear water. As Callis arrived, Toll pushed out the nearest stool with his foot, not taking his gaze from the bustling harbour. They sat a while in silence, listening to the sounds of civilization. It had taken many harsh months for the city to recover from the horror of war and the shock of Vermeer's betrayal. Life continued, of course. You could hardly afford the luxuries of grief and self-pity in the wilds of the Beastlands. But before Callis had left, there had been a foreboding sense of gloom, a lack of trust between even those who had formerly been trusted neighbors. It seemed at last that the wounds were healing.
"She's gone, then," said Toll.
Callis raised an eyebrow.
"Shev told you she was leaving?"
"No. But you're up and out of bed before the sun's reached its apex, and you've got a general hangdog look about you that I happen to recognize quite well."
Callis sighed and gestured to the barkeep for a mug of ale.
"I'm at peace with it," he said. "It was her decision. I knew she wasn't the type to stick around for long. I think Excelsis still holds bad memories for her. She says we may see each other again one day."
Toll nodded, and had the good grace to not point out how incredibly unlikely that was.
"I'm sorry, Armand," he said, scratching at the stump of his arm, where his coat had been folded over and stitched up.
"How is it?" Callis asked, suddenly quite keen to change the subject.
"The arm? Having two was far more convenient, if I'm being honest, but I'll manage. The tails were right, though. You still feel it after it's gone. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, reach for a cup of water, and realize."
He looked like he was about to speak further, but simply shook his head.
"Will you get a replacement?" asked Callis.
He had seen several iron weld engineers and free guild officers who had been grafted with intricate mechanical arms to replace those lost through war or unfortunate accident. They were awkward and cumbersome for the most part, but still mostly effective. Toll shook his head.
"For now, it's a fair reminder of what happens when I drop my guard. Before I rush to fix this wound, I want to get used to what it means, the difficulties it poses me. I mistrust simple, swift solutions.
They sat another while in silence. It was a pleasure simply to be amongst civilization again, after so many months at sea. Callis peered off into the distance, seeing a violet-crimson sail on the horizon.
That's the Blood Drake, he said, gesturing towards the departing vessel. Xenthi's new flagship, formerly the property of our old friend, High Captain Kaskin. The good captain's off again on her travels.
Toll nodded.
I paid my debt to her in full. She's not one to stay still too long, if she can help it.
What was it? The city treasury? A blood sacrifice? Your firstborn child?
The witch hunter gave a slight twitch of amusement.
No. I gave her the location of her father.
Xenthi has a father? I assumed she was descended from a gyre shark. Not much of a price for ferrying us halfway across the realm.
It is for Arika. She's off to claim his head and nail it to her prow.
Callis glanced at Toll, who waved a hand wearily.
It's a long story. I'll tell it to you another time.
A Duardin steam cog was pulling into port ahead of them, kicking gouts of greyish smoke into the air from a row of short black funnels. Its wide-open bay was filled with piles of black coal that shimmered with a faint silver light. The dockmaster, a wizened little man who insisted upon being carried everywhere in a sedan chair, arrived as if summoned from the ether. Leaning out of the window of his chair, he began to shout and holler at the stoically unimpressed Duardin captain, who was covered head to toe in grime so thick it seemed as if he was wearing pitch-black overalls. Callis couldn't stifle a grin.
I never thanked you, Armand, said Toll,
meeting Callis's gaze for the first time.
It would have been the sensible thing to leave me behind in that place. But you didn't. You risked your life to save mine, and I won't forget it.
Callis didn't really know what to say to that, so he simply gave his companion a brief, awkward nod, and accepted the proffered ale brought over by the broad-shouldered innkeep, passing the man a handful of glimmerings. They watched as the dockmaster and his hirelings continued to wage their war of words with the Duardin steamheads, which grew steadily more foul-mouthed and inarticulate until it suddenly and unexpectedly culminated in a shake of hands and a transition of coin and goods. Triumphant, the elderly dockmaster was carried forth on his mighty steed, onwards to the next glorious victory. Diplomacy writ small, Callis thought with a smile.
We have orders, said Toll,
fetching a clutch of papers from his coat.
We're leaving Excelsis again. The Indefatigable's refueling and finalizing repairs as we speak. I managed to talk Admiral Bengtson into giving us passage. The least he could do, considering the king's ransom he earned from our last voyage. I'd make all the goodbyes to this city you think necessary, because we won't be coming back here for quite some time.
Well, that's all right, said Callis. I'm ready to move on.
Good, because we'll travel further than we ever have before. Our path takes us across realms, Armand, beyond the edge of this map, and on to a whole new one, to the Jade Kingdoms and beyond.
That was Callis and Toll, The Silver Shard, by Nick Hawth, read by Barnaby Edwards. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2018.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.